Hello, car fans. Welcome to another episode of the Motor1.com Test Car Happy Hour. I am managing editor of Motor1.com in the US, Brandon Turkus. Joining me is the beheaded Mr. Jeff Perez.
Hello.
And the bespectacled Mr. Brett T. Evans. How are you, gentlemen?
Doing great.
So good. I heard beheaded at first and was very...
That's what beheaded. I heard too, and I was confused.
Beheaded. Beheaded. Yes,
like not beheaded. Malibu Stacy, new with hat.
So we've got a lot to get to in this hour. We've got some very exciting, very, very expensive things. We got a very British lean to this episode, which I just now realized. So we'll be talking about the Rolls-Royce Spectre, which I drove last week, the Aston Martin DB12, which Jeff drove a minute ago. That we had a nice long embargo lead time on that. Brett has been in the Land Rover Defender 130, that is the bigger, boxier box, and Jeff is also driving right now the Lexus RZ. So, gentlemen, where would you guys like to start? Look at just chomping at the bit.
I should start with RZ because I think that's going to be the worst one.
You think?
Yeah, well, of my two, it's definitely the worst. Yeah, so this is the Lexus RZ, their first fully electric SUV. This is the premium, so it's like the base version, basically. You can get the luxury with bigger wheels, actual leather, some other fancy stuff. And yeah, it's a good Lexus. It does the comfortable stuff really well. Like the interior is really nice. It doesn't feel any different than like a Lexus RX or an NX. It feels really comfortable. Great faux leather on this one. You can get real leather on the luxury model.
So real quick, it is fake leather, but like their entire thing is like it's a cruelty free leather. It's a artificial leather because that's what is sustainable, right?
Yeah, I believe so. But it's really good. Like I wouldn't have known it wasn't real leather until I really looked at it. You can feel a little bit of sponginess on the steering wheel, which was kind of a weird feeling. That would be the only giveaway for me. But the seats and everything feel really nice. And then this color is great, and it has a great name. Thunderstorm and Macadamia. It's like a gray, blue, and kind of like beige combo. It's really good. And then, yeah, you get this big touchscreen right in the center, 14.3 inches, new Lexus interface. It's really good as a luxury car. I think it's just on the EV front, it really falls short on a lot of areas. So 71.4 kilowatt hour battery pack, not tiny, but not like amazing. 150 kilowatt DC fast charging. Again, pretty good for the segment, or pretty good in general. But then you only get 220 miles of range on this one with the base 18-inch wheels, or 196 miles with the 20-inch wheels, which it's 2023. At this point, if your car doesn't get over 200 miles at least, it's kind of a flop in that respect, I think, because I was looking at some of the other stats in Brett's first drive review, and it's like Q4 e-tron, GV60, all those other new EVs that came out either before it or right around the same time, all well over 200, 250, some over 300. So it's so strange to me that Lexus came out with this car and just sort of whiffed on the range. And I guess that's sort of the case with the BZ4X too. Just knowing what our friends at Inside EVs and other people have said about it, that the range is just bad and the efficiency is bad. So I don't know. I'm having a hard time with this one because, like I said, it's a decent luxury crossover, but it's a pretty bad EV.
Lexus was pretty, I mean, they weren't frank about, you know, they didn't like openly cop to the specs being, you know, substandard, because they never would. But one thing they did do was they kind of like couched it by saying Lexus customers, most of them own homes, most of them have off-street parking and garages and things like that. They're going to be charging most of the time at home. And then they also, you know, in the US at least, Lexus is going to be giving RZ owners a certain amount of like free loans every year. You can just go to your Lexus dealer. You can get any car in the Lexus lineup for free. And and do your long road trips. And I think that that's all kind of like a tacit admission that they know that this car is substandard when you're comparing it to the GV60 or, you know, like a base version of the BMW iX or even like the BMW i4. You know, it just really is kind of behind the times.
So here's a question that we always tend to ask with these kind of more mediocre EVs. Is this a compliance car, do you think? Is this just like Lexus saying we needed to have an EV out there and we'll just take the BZ4X and do it with that?
Well, it feels like Toyota.
I don't think so, because they have a huge lineup of hybrids and plug-in hybrids that are thoroughly decent that kind of like tick some of those compliance boxes, you know? Like, this isn't a company that has a huge lineup of gas guzzlers that needs to like cut its average emissions and fuel economy.
Lexus, but in general,
decent.
Yeah. In general, though, it feels like Toyota and Lexus have just been behind on the EV stuff. Like, they've been so slow to make progress in this. Like, this car feels like the I-Pace did, was it almost 10 years ago when that thing came out, or when the original e-tron came out? Like,
I drove the I-Pace in 2018, so it's only been 5 years, which is kind of wild to think about. Yeah.
So it feels like that car when it came out, and the original e-tron when it came out, like, they're almost there with their range. They're almost there with a few things, but it's also 2023, and they're way behind at this point based on the range and everything else, and everything that a lot of other cars get. So it's kind of a weird one. And then I just had nonstop charging issues, which, again, we can never fully tell if it's the infrastructure or the car itself, but I plugged into EA and it was charging at like 35 kilowatts. And I left that station, or I left that specific charger to go to another one to see if it was the charger. Someone pulled in behind me with an iX on the exact station I was just at, and they were charging at 140. So I don't know. It could be a combination of both the charger and the car having issues, but I just have been super underwhelmed by this car as an EV.
So I want to talk about the exterior design, because I think in some ways Lexus did a really good job of differentiating the front and rear clips from the BZ4X. But then I also see a lot of details that it just feels like they whiffed on. The giant, giant grill that is just body color.
I hate it. It's awful.
It just feels unfinished. It feels like they stapled that Lexus badge to it and were like, that'll do. And the wheels are, I know smaller wheels are better for range, but my God, I haven't seen a Lexus with sidewalls like that since I drove the LX.
The front end is bad. You can get it in black and it helps a little bit. It sort of makes it look like a faux grill. No, Brett's shaking his head. No, I kind of like it with the black. I think it actually looks better. And the plastic is really cheap. Like, I was rubbing it down. Also, a bug magnet. That thing just eats bugs all day. So I was wiping it down, and the plastic just feels really cheap on the front end. I actually really like the back end. I think they did a good job with that single full width light bar. And there's some really cool details. It's actually an interesting little notch sort of at the top and the rear pillar that gives it a unique little design touch that I think is pretty interesting. The wheels are bad, I agree, but you can get the 20 inches if you really don't care about range, and they look a whole hell of a lot better. So it's like a give and take, you know, if you want style or range, so, even though you're only getting 25 extra miles.
So here's my question for you, actually for both of you guys, because you've both driven this thing. Based on the drive experience and the interior, do you think that this is something that Lexus customers will even consider, or is it just for that small subset of like traditional Lexus buyers that are looking to dip their toe into EVs?
Feels like a trade-in to me, honestly. You know, like it's sized very similarly to the RX, if you're not looking at the cargo area at least. You know, the technology is all going to feel very familiar to anyone who's driving an NX or an RX right now. So I think it's really going to be a great trade-in car for someone who just likes the Lexus ecosystem. I don't think it's going to get conquest at all. I think that there are too many really great luxury EVs out there, and even like commodity EVs that have like some cool technology and luxury features. I think it's going to be really hard to talk someone into buying one of these when they're cross shopping it. But you know, like it as a Lexus, I think it's great. And I was really impressed when we drove it, when Kyle and I had it for a day. I was really impressed with the just the like refinement and smoothness. Like a lot of EVs have a really hard time with wind noise because they don't have like the big engine that's just creating a bunch of white noise to drown it out. And I think that they did a great job with this one, making it feel refined and smooth and polished. And it has power, which is great. The BZ4X does not have power, even in all-wheel drive form, and this one does. So, you know, it has like a competent, confident driving experience. Not necessarily thrilling in any way, but I think it feels like a Lexus.
Yeah, it drives a lot like the RX or the NX, and it's definitely somewhere in between that in terms of sizing. I don't think it's going to get any Audi buyers or BMW buyers to come over and say, oh, this is the EV I want. But if you have an RX and you maybe want to do an EV and there's an easy transition there to the RZ, that feels pretty natural. And assuming you have a home charger, it's easy to charge at home and you're not super worried about range. So I think it makes a lot of sense from that aspect. And 59 grand to start is not terrible. I don't have the RX price in front of me, but that's got to be pretty close. And then this one was 61,775 with the tech package and then the silver paint. So it's loaded nicely. It's got a lot of features, not a ton of options to add on to hike the price up unless you want the luxury version. So as a Lexus, it's not bad.
Well, I think the one thing that's really important that we keep in mind too is that Lexus buyers love the Lexus dealership experience. And this is the only EV that you can get that experience with. So if there are people that are really in love with their dealers, that might be enough in and of itself. Is this being sold in all 50 states?
Yes,
I believe so. Yeah.
Okay. And then the one thing that your car does not have, Jeff, but that Brett has some experience is with the yoke, or are they still calling it OMG, which is almost as bad as Watts to Freedom?
They are not. That's a Lexus Europe branding. Lexus USA is still working on theirs. When the system gets, I don't know if it's waiting approval, if they're just doing like a late availability thing. But I got to say that the like yoke is really, really cool. I was really surprised at how natural it felt. There's a video on Motor One's TikTok and Reels on Instagram that shows, you know, when you're driving at high speed and you do this with the yoke, the car behaves like it's a traditional steering wheel. But when you're at low speeds and you do this with the yoke, it gives you a lot more steering lock. So you don't have to, you know, the steering wheel itself literally only does about 270 degrees of movement. It doesn't do like a full turn even. So it was really funny and really interesting to use. And I was actually surprised at how natural it felt. And I think that's going to be first, it's a way better setup than the Tesla yoke because it doesn't have that hand over hand thing. And then it also, I think it's going to be kind of a funny leg up that, you know, Lexus customers are going to be like, hey, look at this cool feature that my car has that your BMW iX and that your Audi e-tron doesn't have. And I think that's going to kind of be like at least a novelty selling feature that will give people something to brag about.
Well, I for one hope that it does not become a novelty feature because I think it's terrible and I don't want to see it on cars, but I also haven't driven it. So I was
so skeptical. I thought it was going to be so twitchy and so nervous, and it's really pretty darn good in most situations. Definitely not what you want in like a performance car because there's no linearity at all. It's not terribly predictable, but I was really impressed. So if you get a chance to drive it, let me know what you think.
So let's move on to our next vehicle. And Brett, since you just gave us that good breakdown on the RZ and the yoke, let's talk about the vehicle that you have been driving, the bigger box.
Yeah, they dropped a beautiful Defender 130 off on my driveway. It is Sedona red. It is absolutely gorgeous. I love it. I think it's such a cool, interesting automobile. I took this video in my backyard a couple of minutes ago, and it's just a stunner, as you can plainly see.
Your backyard is looks like Northern Africa a little bit.
Yeah, conveniently enough.
They're doing great things with landscaping in LA, aren't they?
I paid a lot of landscapers good money to make that happen. The architecture alone was, you know, at least $15. No, it's great though. It's really, really an awesome, awesome machine. If we get a good scrolling shot, sorry, I was getting artistic. There we go. That's the money shot right there. I love it. I thought it was going to look a little ungainly and like excessively long when I saw it in photos, but in person, it looks totally natural. It like definitely definitely longer and not quite as stubby as the 110, and certainly not as stubby as the 90, but I just can't get enough of it. I think it's so cool. And the best part about it is the third row seat is like genuinely useful. I don't know that I'd want to put three people back there for a long amount of time, but two people for sure. And then the second row seat slides forward and rearward so that you can kind of prioritize space if that's something you want to do. So I just kind of, I really like it. It's kind of, I think it's probably my favorite Defender. If I was looking for, you know, a family car, this would be very high on the list. I think it's just really, really cool.
That's a really bold statement, because every and mind you, I haven't seen one of these in person, but every image I've seen of it, it just looks incredibly ill proportioned. But that could also be because I think the 90 has perfect proportions. So
every time I see the 90 now, I liked it when, sorry, go ahead, Jeff.
No, I was just going to say, you haven't read my review yet of the Defender 130, because my whole review basically is how weird it looks because of all that rear overhang.
Perfect. I love when we're really like cohesive with our message. It's good.
I agree with Brandon that the 90 has like perfect proportion. So when you see this and all that rear overhang, it just looks really odd to me.
I liked the 90 when it came out for sure, but now that the 110 is the one that I'm seeing more often, I think the 90 looks like stubby, and it's fun, it's sporty, it's kind of cool, but like it looks like chopped to me. It looks kind of like it's been bobbed, that's fine, you know, nothing wrong with that, but I don't know, there's something about it that I really dig about the 130, and it kind of just feels like, honestly, like it feels, this is a stupid thing to say and I'm going to really regret it, but it feels very like, I feel comfortable driving it. It feels me. I like driving an SUV, as it turns out. I wouldn't have thought that, you know, a few years ago, but I really like driving this thing. It just like feels big and strong and cool. And I feel like if I had five kids, that would be the one that I want to get, just so that like I wouldn't have to get like a minivan or an SUV, which is so, or like a Suburban, which is so antithetical to who I used to be 5 years ago. I used to be like, no, get a Sienna. But now I'm kind of like, sure, spend 90 grand on a Defender. Why not?
Well, that's the thing. So these three-row Defenders, and for real quick, I want to take a moment to say hello to our most loyal fan, Mr. Kevin Hawthorne from Lakeland, Florida, tuning in. These three-row Defenders are not exactly cheap, even relative to the 90 or the 110. They're pretty expensive, even for like a six-cylinder model, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's starts at like 67. I just built one with the base six cylinder and it got up to 78, pretty meagerly optioned. The one that I'm driving right now is very well equipped and it is $87,000 and it doesn't even have adaptive cruise control. So it is not a cheap proposition in the slightest, for sure. But
is this the six cylinder or the V8 you have?
This is the six cylinder. The V8 starts at like 110, I think. Okay. So, and it's, I actually think that might be cheaper than if you got a 130 or 110 V8. Cause I think the 130 is not like the fully loaded, like Black Series Carpathian edition, whatever. I think it's like a more meagerly optioned spec, but.
So yeah. The one concern I have right now for the Defender 130 is the new Lexus GX, which I think is just going to eat its lunch.
I mean, especially if they keep the pricing where the current GX is, it's going to be a really hard sell.
But is it going to have the stupid Sequoia third row where it doesn't fold flat and there's stuff, the batteries underneath the floor?
No, because the GX isn't a hybrid yet. The hybrid version might, but the GX that we're getting first is just a twin turbocharged 3.5 liter V6. And I mean, we've seen photos of the rear seat of the GX, and obviously we need to get inside it and crawl around it first, but the photos alone look like it's probably three times as big as that of the Sequoia.
Mm. Well, go ahead, Jeff.
I was just going to say, I like the third row of the 130 a lot. I was actually surprised. I thought it was going to be a little bit cramped back there, but I was pretty happy back there just sitting for a little bit. Like you said, probably not three people wide, but two adults can be back there and be comfortable for a bit.
Well, yeah, the main reason I was bringing up the GX is because I think I'm the only one that's actually seen it in person. We did the first look video in Austin about a month ago now. Wow. And it looks so much more natural and comfortable in its body than the 130 does. There's really none of that like ill-proportioned, you know, extra long stretch that you get in the GX. And part of that is probably because it's a new shape and we hadn't seen one before and there is no shorter version of it. But yeah, it just, to me, like looking at it while I was in Austin, it seemed like a more natural, comfortable vehicle than the 130. And I'm almost certain it'll come better equipped, especially in terms of safety equipment. And that's something for sure. That I really worry about for a brand like Land Rover, where it's like, you know, this is an $87,000 car and it doesn't have adaptive cruise control. That's kind of unforgivable.
That's the most irksome thing about every non-Japanese luxury brand. It drives me crazy. I don't understand. If it's a $500 option, just make it standard. You're making more than that on the car, I promise you. Just make it standard and stop nickel and diming. It's the worst cliche about import cars, that you get a box with some air in it and then you have to pay for everything else. And drives me crazy. It drives me crazy about this car. It drives me crazy about the BMW i4 I was in a couple weeks ago. It's so asinine to me.
I thought that six cylinder was a little underwhelming in the 130. It definitely feels like a heavy SUV, and you really have to put your foot in the throttle pretty decently to get it up to speed. Whereas the GX is going to have that twin turbo V6 that is on, I think it's the same Tundra engine, right?
Same as the LX and the Tundra. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's an awesome engine. So that's another, I don't know. I don't know if you feel the same way about the six cylinder on this one.
I mean, I haven't driven the 130, but I've got a lot of experience with that six cylinder. I've always kind of appreciated it, but I'd be worried. Is this much, much heavier than a 110?
Or is it? I don't think it's a ton heavier because it's mostly just body work. There's not a lot of like structural, you know, changes. It's probably a few hundred pounds heavier. I was driving it around yesterday and I had it in eco mode, and eco mode is dull as dull gets. Like, you really have to flog it if you want to go anywhere. But in sport or like normal mode, even, it was a lot more responsive. I didn't really have any complaints. I wasn't driving it fast or far, but it seemed perfectly adequate to me.
So,
Brian, but I mean, the twin turbo in the Tundra is brilliant, and I'm sure the GX is going to be a little bit more nimble and a little bit more sporty than this thing. It's kind of a lumbering brute for sure. Every Defender is, and this one even more so because it's so long and a little bit heavier.
Have either of you had a chance to off-road in this yet? Do we think the extra length is going to be problematic? I'm sure the departure angle is worse, right?
It's like 10 degrees worse, which is significant. I didn't get to off-road in it. I did like some dirt road driving, which is, you know, doesn't tell you anything. But the fact that you can do it with eight people inside is pretty impressive. I always like the idea of a three-row off-roader. I just think that's so fun. And I think the angle at 20, it's still 20 something, departure angle is better than, it's better than
the 90 and the 110 have the same departure angle because they don't have a rear bumper. They literally just like go right down to the axle. So even if this thing is 10 degrees worse, it's still excellent.
Yeah, it's still pretty good. So,
and they kept the wheelbase the same. So it's going to have the same breakover as well. Most of the other dimensions are going to be similar.
So should we move on to British car part two of our British car episode?
Yeah.
Let's talk about your V12 adventure in Monte Carlo. You very posh man.
Not a V12. V8.
Or not a V12. That's right. A V8. See, I just fumbled already.
DB12 with a V8.
Yeah. See, there
we go. So yeah, new Aston Martin DB12. I got to go to the south of France, which is never bad thing, and drive this car, and it is a very, very, very good car. I don't think that I was expecting it to be a bad car, but I think I was a little impressed still with how just dynamic and fast, insanely fast. It's the most powerful car in the class. Aston Martin puts it up against the McLaren GT, the Ferrari Roma, and the Bentley Continental. So it's a little bit more powerful than all of those, 671 horsepower. Still a Mercedes V8, which is not bad because those are amazing engines. But everything else they did with this car is basically bespoke. There are a few, Brandon brought this up in my review when we were editing it, and Aston Martin is really like, they really hammered home the bespoke stuff, like this interior right here. All of that is brand new, totally new infotainment system. But they're still using like seats from Geely and a few other things. So it's a little bit, I guess my point is that compared to some of the other ones, this feels really fleshed out. Like the infotainment system is brand new and way better than the old Mercedes stuff. But it's still not 100% like there as a full bespoke, you know, vehicle. But I don't think that's ever been Aston's MO. They've always sort of borrowed from here and there. Anyways, I'm rambling now. The Aston Martin is very good, and I like it a lot.
So tell me this, because just as I'm looking at it, does this really deserve to be a DB12, or is it more like a DB11.5? Because I look at it and I'm like,
Yeah, it definitely feels like a DB11, like a very good, very comprehensive DB11 facelift. I like the design actually more than I do the DB11. I know the grille is kind of controversial for how big and crazy it is. But they really tweaked everything else really, really nicely. Like the hood's a little higher up, or the hood line's a little higher up. The headlights are different. You get those frameless mirrors that are really nice. Like it's a subtle thing, but when you compare them side by side with the DB11, it makes an actual difference. And then you just have that one crease that goes across the side profile that just starts, you know, that little thing above the wheel wells, and it goes all the way to the back. It is a really, really good looking car. And this isn't even a good color. This is the matte silver that I drove. And you can obviously get it in green. You can get it in red. You can get it in blue, which I would recommend. But the matte is cool. The matte is really nice.
That shoulder line is really, can we rewind to that? Because I think it's just, especially in a matte color, like it shows it off so nicely. And like especially the power lines on the hood. I mean, this color really does a lot of favors to that bodywork.
Yeah, that hood is really cool. Those lines on the hood are really nice. And yeah, to your point, the matte just like, all those lines are just accentuated even more when the matte paint, as opposed to the gloss. So
pretty slick.
Yeah,
I like it. I mean, I haven't been a huge fan of Aston Martin since like probably, you know, 2012 DBS era, like the James Bond era. But I like this one a lot. I do think it's kind of funny that, like, if you believe the rumors, Aston skipped the DB8 because they didn't want people to think that their DB car had an 8-cylinder engine. And now they have a DB12 with an 8-cylinder engine. So I think it's a little yeah, hypocritical naming wise.
I think they skipped the DB8 because they just didn't want it to be like people to call it the Aston Martin debate. Sorry, that's a bad joke.
Yeah, it sure was.
We usually leave the dad jokes to Brett.
Well, it's only 4 liters too. So smallest, I put this in my review, smallest displacement since the DB7, which is kind of interesting, but you know, twin turbocharged Mercedes. Even smaller
than the DB7, because the DB7 had a 4.2 inline six, and then it had a 6 liter V12.
I thought it was a 3.2 inline six.
You might be right. Yeah, I actually think you're right.
It is.
Yeah. It was like 4.2 inline six would be awesome. So tell us about the interior, because you really raved about like the specialness of the interior when in your review, Jeff.
Yeah, they did a really good job. And like I was trying to say earlier before I lost my train of thought, they really like every volume knob, the drive mode dial, that big chunky drive mode dial just right around the gear there, the start button. It's just everything feels really nice and really premium, really heavy. Like you can like tick your fingers on the top of those buttons and it'll give off a little clink. And that was part of what they wanted to do to make this car feel more premium inside, because you guys have driven some of the Aston stuff of the past, the DBS and the Vantage. They're nice, but they're not amazingly premium inside. They definitely feel like borrowed. They definitely feel like they have a lot of borrowed parts. The infotainment system was a big upgrade too, because the old Mercedes unit was pretty bad in the last Vantage that I drove. It was bad.
It was Command, right? It was like the 2013 system.
Just terrible graphics. It had the rotary dial still, I think, but the graphics were just awful and the response was terrible.
Yeah, that's not the rotary dial isn't a huge consolation prize because it was pretty awful to use.
Yeah. So having a big fancy touchscreen, new graphics, like totally updated infotainment system is a huge, huge improvement. And for a touring car like this, like you, especially if you're going up against the Continental and the Roma, all those cars are really fully fleshed out and they have really nice interiors that you're going to, you know, drive along the coast in Monaco and you're going to want to be comfortable. And the DB12 does a really good job of that. So I really like the interior.
Where does the infotainment come from in the DB12?
That's the thing. They said it's bespoke. They said it's fully bespoke from the ground up. I know that they have partnered with other manufacturers for like the Valkyrie infotainment. So they were kind of cagey on the details.
Is it, you don't have any video of it, do you? Of the infotainment?
No, just this video.
I'm kind of curious if, because they work a little bit with Geely, right? And Geely supplied, Geely and Lincoln Co. supplied the infotainment for the Emira, the Lotus Emira.
Yeah, it could be, it could be Geely. Yeah, they really talked about it being unique, which could mean they just put a reskin on a Geely infotainment system. But it's really good. I mean, it's not, it doesn't feel like, it doesn't feel like it's a copy and paste job from anything I've driven. So I don't think it's a huge deal if it is.
One of these days we're going to do an episode of it where it's an actual happy hour. We just sit around and take a shot while we read British press releases and drink every time they say bespoke.
Yeah, they use that word a lot for this car, especially. So, but it's good. I liked it a lot.
Would you buy one?
I think everyone should go to the link that we have in the comments right there to Jeff's first drive review and read the very first line, because it sums up the whole damn car.
Yeah. Would I buy one? That's tough because I haven't driven a ton of cars in this segment. I actually really like the Ferrari Portofino a lot when I drove it. I think it was a little more of a touring car than this was. The interesting thing about the DB11 is that, or the DB12, that's a mistake, but it is really variable. Like you can be pretty comfortable in this car, and then it also feels like a genuine sports car when you notch it all the way up to Sport Plus and play with the paddle shifters and stuff. It's pretty variable, but it's not as comfortable, I would say, as like a Portofino. So I'm assuming it's not going to be as comfortable as like a Bentley Continental.
That's where I was kind of right. Cause I genuinely love every version of the current Continental, and I really struggle to buy anything else in this class. So I was curious to hear what your take on it was.
I think this is more for the performance, fan. If you're a GT, if you still want a GT car that's more of a performance car, I would say this is probably the one. I think Roma, I'm guessing, comes pretty close to this in terms of performance, but 671 horsepower, that is a lot of horsepower.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty cool car. I think this would probably be my choice in that class. Maybe Portofino, maybe Roma would be a close second, but especially, you know. But when I tell you, when they do the Volante version of this car, I think this is going to be probably my very high on my favorite cars.
Oh, yeah.
That's okay. So
I'm a convertible guy. You know this.
I know. It's just I haven't really loved an Aston Martin Volante since like 2012, like back when it was like DB9 and V8 Vantage. But I mean, I think the lines and the shape of them just worked better with a convertible. So, but maybe I've got bad takes. We've covered this.
I mean, whether it's prettier or not, I don't care, because I like a convertible, period. Okay. So, you know, it doesn't need to be pretty. I recognize fully that the Z4 Coupe is much more attractive than the Z4 Roadster, but here I am driving a Z4 Roadster.
Yeah, so some bias there. So let's talk about our final car, and this is the one that I drove last week in Napa, California, with a friend of the pod, Stephen J. Ewing, in the co-driver seat. It is the Rolls-Royce Spectre. It is Rolls-Royce's first all-electric vehicle, all-electric production vehicle. The company has been playing around with electrification for years now. There have been a couple of wild concepts. And right away, I want to go after the elephant in the room, because in the comments section, if you read my review at Inside EVs or Motor One, there were a lot of people taking issue with the range and the charge speed. Rolls-Royce is expecting an EPA range estimate of around 260 miles, and the peak DC charge rate is 195 kilowatts, which is right on par with the BMW iX in terms of charge speed. And it seemed like in the comments that there were a lot of readers that were like, well, this is a $420,000 car to start. That's pretty poor range. And I definitely respect that argument, but I think more than just about any other automaker short of probably Ferrari, Rolls-Royce is in a position to like communicate with their owners and talk about their needs and what they want. And there are so few brands that are focused so fanatically on serving their customers. And so when Rolls-Royce says 260 miles, 195 kilowatts, more than enough for our customers, they're going to be perfectly happy with it. I tend to believe them. What do you guys think?
Well, if you do the math on like the Wraith, the outgoing Wraith, right? It got like 15, 16 miles per gallon. The fuel tank wasn't huge. I bet it probably got about 260 miles on a tank. So like, it's not that ridiculous. I think 260 miles for as big and heavy of a car as this is actually pretty good. And 195 kilowatt fast charging is pretty high up there for right now. So I don't think it's a big deal at all.
I also would be curious to see what the percentage of Rolls-Royce customers who drive their cars more than 250 miles in a day is. I can't envision this is not a second car for some people. This is not a third or fourth. This is multiple, like dozens of cars. And I just can't envision that they like, if they needed to go 500 miles in a day and needed to get there in 8 hours, I can't envision that they wouldn't take a Bentley Continental Flying Spur or something similar. So
or a jet.
I think that's kind of a silly. Yeah, exactly. It's just kind of a silly argument to me in this echelon of car. 260 miles is not impressive for like a daily driven car for most of us who occasionally do have to drive, you know, 5 or 6 hours and get there quickly. But for someone with Rolls Royce money, they don't care.
Yeah. I just take a lot of issue with it because do you really think that if Rolls Royce wanted to put more mileage in there, they just decided, oh, we can't do that? No, if they thought their customers needed more mileage, they would have gone out of their way to find a way to make it happen. I mean, talking to their engineers and designers about this car during the launch program, so much of what they were saying was, this is what our customers want. This is what we've been told by customers. They want to waft. They want to, everything about driving this vehicle is about making it feel like any other Rolls Royce. And so for that reason, you know, there's a slight delay in the acceleration to better mimic the behavior of a gas powered turbocharged engine. The brakes don't have a lot of regen so that it feels more like a conventional Rolls-Royce when you're coming to a stop. It doesn't rely on a lot of regen. There is a battery mode that you can tick into and it calls up more regen. But honestly, the brake pedal is so satisfying, I didn't use it. And when you get into this thing, it immediately feels like a Rolls-Royce. You look at the center stack in this video, it's basically the same center stack that you would find in a Wraith or a Phantom or a Ghost. It's the kind of place that it may be an EV, but it feels immediately familiar from the moment the door swings shut, which you can do via a little switch on the center console. I'm not sure I'm going to drive a vehicle this year that impressed me more than the Spectre did. If we want to get into like, you know, the nuts and bolts of it, it's 584 horsepower and 664 pound-feet of torque from two electrically excited motors. These are the fifth-gen BMW motors that do not use rare earth materials, which is great, and I hope more manufacturers get into that. 4.4 seconds to 60, top speed of 105 miles an hour. And sufficient. Yeah, sufficient, adequate, as the Rolls-Royce folks say. But also, it's a hell of a lot of fun to drive when you throw it down a twisty road. You know, it it's not meant to drive the way I was driving it, but it entertained me. And man, it was just magnificent to drive through wine country. I had a fantastic drive. I had to drop my co-driver, Mr. Ewing, off, and I had the car to myself for about an hour and a half. I just drove through these rolling hills through Napa. I had all four windows down. I had the audio system just blaring music. It was one of those drives that you always will remember. And yeah, I mean, this was, I was totally blown away by this thing. It's a peach. I would have one.
Does the Spirit of Ecstasy drop down into the grill while you're driving, or is that just for parking?
No, you can do it automatically, or you can do it. If we can cut back to the interior, there's a number of buttons, like 1, 2, 3, 4 that you can pre-program for, like Rolls-Royce pre-programmed some of them. So like we could turn on or off the acceleration sound, or if we wanted to raise or lower the Spirit of Ecstasy. So it does not go down automatically, or it did not while I was driving. It was only when I commanded it to.
That makes me happy.
Yes, it. But the thing is, the really interesting thing is, if you've driven a Wraith or a Phantom or a Ghost, and that Spirit of Ecstasy is dead center and it is always in your line of sight. And because of the way the nose on this curves down, you just see the top of the wings. You very rarely see the whole thing unless you're like, you know, leaning up and looking for it. The work that Rolls-Royce did to reprofile this and reprofile the Spirit of Ecstasy, tweak the grill, change some of its like key design elements in the name of aerodynamics is really impressive. The drag coefficient on this car is 0.25. Its predecessor, the Phantom Drophead or Phantom Coupe, not the Drophead, the Phantom Coupe, not the Wraith, was 0.35. So to reduce the drag coefficient that dramatically, has a huge impact, and to do it without really like losing that traditional Rolls-Royce design is even more impressive.
Starlight Headliner.
And yeah, that's the thing. You don't really give up any of that Rolls-Royce-ness. Like you can still get the Starlight Headliner. You can still get some really wild shades of leather and exterior paints. I drove a particularly unpleasant looking color called Morganite.
I wish you had pictures to show everybody.
It looks like an old lady smells. I don't recommend it. No one should ever buy that color.
Uncomfortable with that characterization of that color. Oh my gosh.
But it's so accurate. It is so accurate.
Just like made something in my heart and my guts want to jump out of my throat.
Let me put it another way. If you thought back to like the velour upholstery of like a 1984 Chrysler New Yorker, it was that color. It was the color of Morganite.
I'm good with that.
Is that better? That doesn't turn your stomach quite as much?
For sure. Yeah. That's much better.
So yeah, I was absolutely blown away by the Spectre. It is, you know, there's so much pearl clutching from some sides of the industry that electrification is gonna ruin cars and they're never gonna be the same again. And I said this in my review, the Spectre is a giant middle finger to that notion. It is every bit the piece of artistry and craftsmanship that a Phantom or a Ghost or a Wraith or a Dawn was. Yeah, I mean, Rolls-Royce just nailed this thing.
That's a great way of kind of like phrasing it, but like especially cars that don't depend on powertrain personality the Rolls-Royces have had a variety of inline sixes, V8s, V12s, lots of different powertrains. They don't rely on like one specific setup. And even when, you know, you do get a lot of power, they're still so identified and characterized by like the craftsmanship and the interior fittings and the quietness of the car when you're driving down the road. And like, these are all things that an electric motor has no effect on or improves upon, you know?
Yeah. I mean, the whole point of the V12 is they tuned it so that it's anonymous, that it's quiet, silent, and smooth, yeah, and powerful without you knowing it's there. So why would you not be happy with an EV if you're a Rolls-Royce owner? I think every Rolls-Royce should be an EV. Every Bentley should be an EV, really. And in your review too, you noted something interesting of like they even dulled the throttle pressure a little bit so that it's not instant torque, right? It's just it's mm-hmm. like They smoothed it out so that it still feels like a Rolls Royce when you accelerate, which I think is super interesting.
Well, and the thing is, the way they did it, I mean, this is all electronics and software and all that fancy stuff. It's not a hardware thing. But the way they did it, and mind you, it's been a little while since I drove a Rolls Royce, but like, I got in, I'm like, man, this feels like the Cullinan I drove a few years ago. Like, it just the way that the throttle or the accelerator pedal responds to your inputs and the way the power just kind of builds rather than just like being dumped on you all at once, like it would be in like an iX or name another EV. You know, it's really impressive the detail that Rolls-Royce went to make this feel familiar and to make sure that their customers are like, actually, you know what? I am a fan of this. You know, and I didn't mention this in the review, but like, if you think about like the carbon footprint of the people that buy Rolls Royces, it is dramatically larger than any of ours, like almost certainly. So any attempt to reduce that carbon footprint through electrification is, I mean, I'm on board with it. I think we should all be on board with it.
How many miles driven in a Spectre do you have to make up for one private jet flight?
Well, just, I mean, just well, then you got to get into it. Like, think of there's something like 18 cows worth of leather in this thing, and so what's the methane emissions of those 18 cows? We could get totally lost in the math, but I think the idea of Rolls Royce demonstrating to some of the wealthiest individuals on this planet that they can have the things they love with electrification is inherently valuable and good for the planet. Even if, you know, we could question the sustainability of building a $500,000 leather clad 6,300 pound electric car.
I mean, they're going to be buying $500,000 leather clad 6,300 pound cars anyway. We might as well give them ones that don't emit stuff from the tailpipe. You know, like it's all substitution. It's the same thing as like, if you're not ready to go vegetarian, just omit meat from your meal, from your menu one day a week. Like, just little things like that kind of just add up. We're going totally off the rails here, but like,
I think it's a great discussion so far. I mean,
you summed it up really well though. It's just like, hey, you can have everything that you want without tailpipe emissions. Why not? Why don't we just try that for a few, for 3 years? Why don't you just lease one and see what you think? You know, it's just,
and the thing is, if you don't like it, you can turn around and go and buy a Wraith or a Phantom Coupe and get the exact same experience just with gasoline. Yeah. I mean, there's really no loss. So, however, there is going to be a loss tomorrow. You like that segue? Is that good?
That was solid. Good job, dude.
Thank you. Thinking on my feet. Tomorrow is my last day with MotorOne.com and working with these fine individuals. I'm not going to go too deep into it. If you want to hear more about what's going on, check out the MotorOne.com podcast from last week. I wanted to thank everybody that's been watching this and been supporting the site for the past 5 years that I've been here. I'm immensely grateful. It means a huge amount to me. I can't say where I'm going just yet. That'll be at some point tomorrow. So if you follow me on social media, on Instagram or Threads, which is a thing now, or Facebook, you'll get all the news there. But I am immensely grateful to you, the viewers and the readers, and Jeff and Brett and Seth and Kyle and everybody that makes Motor One what it is. Thank you guys so much for a fantastic 5 years, and I will miss you all very dearly.
It has been an absolute pleasure.
It's been a lot of fun.
Sometimes. But no.
I'm glad you helped make Motor One what it is today, and all the work that you did to make our reviews and everything like that very accessible and usable and solid, dude, and a huge loss for the team for sure.
Absolutely.
Thank you guys. I will miss you all. I'll miss all the readers. Thank you guys for everything. The Motor One Test Car Happy Hour will be back next week. Or actually, no, it probably won't. Some of you guys are going across the pond. Mm.
Might just be me.
Just Jeff vamping. So
yeah,
in a couple weeks with the Motor One Test Car Happy Hour, we'll probably be back.
I will be watching 45 minutes of Jeff holding his rabbit up to the camera.
Oh, where's Fergus?
What he thinks.
He's got a Fergus cameo?
He has a lot to say. He's in the other room, but I'm sure he has a lot to say about cars.
All right. Well, let's wrap this thing up. Thank you guys, everyone, for watching. Jeff, Brett, pleasure as always. And these guys will see you next time. Thanks a lot. Bye.